Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the fifth and penultimate episode of Celebration of Cinema, or Celebrate Our Cinemas, the limited edition series of podcasts brought to you by Empire in association with those fine and funky folks at Meerkat Movies from Compare the Market. Apologies for my voice, by the way. I was at a football match over the weekend and I yelled myself hoarse and I haven't quite recovered. So there you go. Anyway, in case you are a newcomer to this series, the goal of the show is simple. Now the cinemas have reopened their doors, we want to celebrate them. Pure and simple. So each week I interview someone from the world of film about the movies and the movie-going experiences that shaped them. What, for example, was the film that lit a fire under their cinematic backsides? What film made them laugh the most, cry the most, or scared the bejesus out of them the most? What's their favourite cinema in the whole wide world? And, of course, perhaps most important of all, what is their movie snack of choice? This week brings an unexpected spark and an unexpected sparks to the show. Russell Mail and Ron Mail are the brothers behind Sparks, the delightfully odd art pop duo who've been making gloriously catchy music for five decades or more. You may have seen them in Edgar Wright's recent documentary about them, The Sparks Brothers. And in that, you may have learned that in addition to their musical careers, they're massive film buffs as well, and have actually been trying to make movies for a while now, getting frustratingly close to the start line with the Tim Burton-directed project a few years back. That didn't happen, obviously, but what did make it in front of the cameras is Leos Carax's Annette, a startlingly surreal and brilliant slice of utter madness, which stars Adam Driver and Marianne Cotillard as a married couple who have a child. And that's all I'm going to say on that, except to say that it is a rock opera par excellence, propelled by a script and songs by Sparks that will live rent-free in your head, in the same way that Jurgen Klopp lives rent-free in Pep Guardiola's head. The movie is out this week, and so naturally I jumped at the chance to talk to Ron and Russell over Zoom from their respective homes in LA. We talked about a great many things, including the struggle to get Annette to the big screen, and of course, their cinematic memories, including one or two big old surprises. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on this very, very special Celebration of Cinema podcast by the co-writers, the co-creators of Annette, Russell Mail and Ron Mail, better known collectively, of course, as Sparks. How are you both, gents?
Doing well, thanks. Yeah.
Excellent. How are you doing, Ron?
Doing almost as well. Yes. Yeah. Doing well.
Excellent. Excellent. Do you check in with each other every day? Just make sure you're both even keel?
We make the phone call. Are you doing well? Yes, I'm doing well. Okay, talk to you tomorrow.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on Annette. I know that this has been a labor of love for you, that you've been working on it for many, many years. In a way, and this is one of the themes, of course, that crops up in the documentary, The Sparks Brothers, that Edgar Wright directed earlier on this year. There's a great deal, there's a theme of perseverance that runs through your career, because you've been down the road, cinematically speaking, with directors in the past, most notably Tim Burton, and didn't quite get off the runway. But you keep on going, you keep on trying. Was that something that kept you refueled all the way through the process with Annette?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were really passionate ourselves just from the beginning with this project that we originated called Annette 9 years ago. And we thought it was going to be Sparks' next album. And it was something that we could perform live on stage as Sparks, doing sort of a more theatrical presentation. So we were passionate about this project, no matter what form it would ultimately take. And then it took a detour when we met Leos Carax in Cannes at the Cannes Film Festival 8 years ago. He had used one of Sparks' songs in his last film, Holy Motors. So we thanked him and met him and wanted to just tell him we were fans of his work as well. And then we had this project ready to go for ourselves. And then we said, we'll just send it to Leos when we got back to LA, and just out of curiosity to see what he thought about it, because he's a fan of Sparks and wanted to just keep him up to date what we were up to. And then he got back to us after a couple of weeks and said, you know, I'd really like to direct this as my next film. And so it kind of veered off course of being a Sparks album. And then it became a movie musical with Leos Carax directing, and then escalated into Adam Driver taking the lead role and Marion Cotillard. So it kind of sort of this little project that we kind of thought was our own then happily took on a different course. And so then it was one of those situations of perseverance, but we had an ally with Leos Carax that he single-mindedly worked on this project for all of that time. It wasn't like one of 15 films he had in development, like so many other directors do, like Tim Burton, for instance. You know, he has lots and lots of films in development. So if one doesn't happen for various reasons, or isn't like the perfect film at that time, you can kind of jump onto something else. But to Leos's credit, he single-mindedly focused on this film for that long. And so I think that made the situation kind of different than our past experiences that we had. And he was so passionate about the project as well, just loved it for so many different reasons, and was able to, you know, to give it to Adam Driver, who was equally passionate about the project as well. And then it kind of took on its own life from there.
In terms of the project itself, I mean, you guys, as we'll get into in a second, you are film buffs, you're film fans, you know your cinematic onions. Did it ever cross your mind about directing this, or directing anything over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Not really, because we had a brief experience directing one of our videos, and it took us 3 months, and it took, you know, just kind of moving away from doing any music for that period. So, you know, we would prefer, you know, to be involved in kind of the writing end and leave it to people that, you know, that we obviously respect greatly. I mean, it isn't just turning it over to anybody to do the directing. I mean, to turn it over to Leos Carax, you have a certain amount of confidence that it's going to, you know, both turn out into something amazing, but also that be in a similar sensibility to what you might have done yourself. So, you know, there's only so much you can kind of do, and we would prefer to focus our energies on the musical. And you know, there's so much that we can, things have opened up for us now in a way that even in the past they haven't, where we can both be working on Sparks albums and film musicals. So that kind of takes up most of the hours of our days.
It feels like such a great marriage, though. It feels like Sparks directed the film.
It kind of feels, we felt that was the one thing when we met Leos at Cannes. It wasn't to kind of pitch him on Annette, but we, you know, you either feel a kinship with somebody, you don't. And we really felt, both on a personal level and just creatively, that we felt that we were on the same wavelength in general. So, you know, it's kind of you to say that, but just, you know, just it's hard to know other ways that Annette could have been done than the way it has been done. But we can't see any other way that would be ideal other than the way that Leos did it.
And there's so many scenes that he chose to do in a certain way that were so in line with our sensibility, like the scene on the ship in the storm at night, the decision whether to do it as a more realistic out in the ocean or to do it within a film studio that's set up to do scenes with water and boats, but within a studio. And he chose the interior way of doing it in a studio. And so it has this kind of a more artificial look to that scene, but in a really beautiful way, really stylized, that wouldn't have happened had it been done for in a outdoor exterior setting on the ocean. So the decisions that he made are so aligned with what we would have liked, any what we did like, and so there was the, you know, it was as though we were, you know, so in tune with each other's tastes.
And Ron, for example, I noticed that behind you there is a book on your bookshelf. Says Cannes Confidential.
Oh yeah.
Now, did you put that there just for this, sir? Or
I bought that in Cannes, and I don't read French very well, but I love the title "Sex, Drugs, and Cinema." It just and dealing with Cannes, so. I don't know anything to do with Cannes now. We've always been huge. You know, you mentioned earlier, just huge film fans, and so when you finally get a chance, not only to go to Cannes, but to have the opening night film playing there that you had a large part in writing it. You know, it's kind of a dreamlike experience. So anyway, this book kind of seemed like it encapsulated a lot of, even though we didn't get too much involved in the issues that are dealt with in this book, I had to buy it anyway.
Well, I did want to ask about that experience in Cannes earlier on this year, because I've asked a number of people on this limited edition series what it's like watching their own movies with an audience. And I asked Olga Kurylenko what it was like being in Cannes and being at a film festival and being part of one of those epic standing ovations, those 5, 10, 15 minute standing ovations you hear about at film festivals. And I'd love to ask you guys as well about your experience, because how long was the standing ovation for Annette at Cannes?
Oh, it seemed like an eternity. We were, you know, it was so long, the ovation after the film, that Leos Carax decided to light up a cigarette during the thing. And obviously there's no smoking allowed, but he's a French director, so I think they cut him some slack. But then not only did he do that, but then the applause continued. So then Adam Driver lit up a cigarette as well. And it just seemed like it was this whole, you know, little vignette was going on for forever. And meanwhile, each time, you know, as soon as the camera turn to Adam and him lighting up, then the whole audience kind of did another round of, you know, the applause continued even louder. So it was a pretty crazy moment. And it was really special for us to be part of it. And, you know, we're standing on the red carpet, you know, overlooking the hundreds of the paparazzi photographers there, and you know, you're shoulder to shoulder with Adam Driver and Marianne Cotillard, and it's like, just like, what are we doing here? But in a positive way.
That was the first time that we'd ever seen Annette with a live audience, and so it was, just surreal.
Because they have horror stories as well of really famous films from the past being kind of booed after the screenings, and you know, films that you know Hitchcock films and stuff, and Fellini films that have been booed, and you kind of go, oh my god, I hope this isn't going to be one of those. And then later, obviously in retrospect, the films are, you know, reassessed for what they are in a more positive way, but we're hoping, oh god, no, please don't do one of those. But fortunately, the reception was amazing.
Absolutely. And of course, you've been on the trail with Edgar as well. You know, you managed to get over here to London a couple of months ago now to watch the Sparks Brothers and to debut it at Sundance London. And what's that experience like? What's it like watching that movie with an audience?
Well, it's kind of funny because it's really touching because there's so many scenes that strike an audience, a Sparks audience, and even people that weren't a Sparks audience before going in to see the documentary on Sparks, that come away with a really, you know, there's a really strong kind of emotional attachment to that film, to the saga kind of the band, that when we, you know, we're so close to it. And when Edgar had done the film, we were always kind of joking about, is there a story? Are we interesting enough to have a movie made about us? And he said, don't worry, you're interesting enough. And so seeing it with an audience and seeing what they react to and the things that strike people kind of in, not only in some of the more lighter moments of the film when you know, it gets a really good reaction in those moments, but a lot of the things that surprised us the most were kind of the more emotional moments in the film. Through some of the periods where, you know, things weren't as, you know, upbeat in the Sparks world for certain reasons that they discuss in the documentary. But those things are the takeaways that a lot of people have seen the film really come away with about what we mentioned earlier about perseverance and all of that, that those kind of themes that Edgar was so well at kind of portraying in the film. It was, those kind of things are really amazing to see with an audience.
Ron, what's it like for you watching your life story unfold on screen with an audience?
Well, you know, it's odd. I mean, we've mentioned this before, but we've always resisted having a documentary made about us just because it seemed like there was some kind of finality to it that we're looking back now. And kind of that isn't our way of seeing things in order to be doing projects like Annette or like a new Sparks album that we always kind of, you know, even if it's self-delusional, we kind of are assuming that our best days are even ahead of us. And so the concept of a documentary about us seemed to be something that would be stifling, but Edgar was the one that really convinced us that wouldn't be the case, both just because he's an incredible filmmaker, but also just that he also saw Sparks as being that all the periods were kind of equal and that it wasn't just focusing on some mythical golden age and, you know, decades ago. So, you know, we were really incredibly pleased with it. You know, you feel a bit naked when you see a documentary about yourself in that way, but we couldn't have been, you know, happier. And, you know, we're just so fortunate because Edgar was the perfect person to direct that documentary in the same way that Leos was the perfect person to direct Annette. So we just got lucky.
So let's get into the weeds now. Let's get into your cinematic lives. What was the cinema that first inspired that love of movies? What was the cinema you remember going to as boys?
Well, we would, our parents would take us to movie theaters. Obviously, there were no multiplexes at that time. So they were really, a lot of them were real movie palaces. And our father would take us usually on Saturday matinees. There would be theaters in, we grew up in Venice, California. And so that's close to where Santa Monica was. And there were a lot of movie theaters in Santa Monica. And, you know, it wasn't that we were seeing art films or anything, because there weren't, for Americans at the time, there weren't art films, except for some elite, you know, university professors. So we were seeing war movies and cowboy movies, things that were really violent. And the other thing was that the movie going experience at that time was such a lengthy kind of full banquet. There were always two films and there were always cartoons. And then trailers for upcoming films. And then it was before there was any kind of 24-hour cable news. So they would have newsreels of the week's events. And so, you know, I remember also people taking popcorn containers after they'd finish everything. During the intermissions, people were throwing them like they were frisbees around, because it was just like a the whole thing was just a full kind of experience. And so it was pretty amazing. And we spent a lot of time going to films when we were early. I mean, we weren't doing it in any kind of intellectual way. It was just a way to spend a Saturday afternoon.
Then it morphed into later on when we went to university. Then it got to be going to see films that then we it was they're foreign films, and it was then the snobism entered into our cinematic palette, and we'd go see, you know, just because you were a hip college student, you had to go see the latest, you know, Fellini film or Antonioni or Ingmar Bergman or, you know, all of the French New Wave, Truffaut, Godard. And so, you know, we kind of grew up on those films too. But at the time, they also didn't seem, you know, they didn't seem privileged films or anything. They just seemed like, oh, these were cool films, what directors were doing, you know, in everywhere else other than America. And so we just thought, oh, why are these films cooler to us than the films that were already existing in the, you know, in Hollywood at that time for us?
There was a really interesting period kind of like earlier where, you know, we grew up at the time where television was starting to really make a dent into people going to theaters. So Hollywood was attempting to kind of keep people going to movie theaters. And, you know, it's the same kind of almost the same story now with streaming and movie theaters. But at the time it was television. And so they had to figure out ways to get, you know, what could they do that would be more than just seeing a movie. So there were things like Cinerama, where there's a big theater still in Hollywood now, the Cinerama Dome. And they shot these films on with three separate cameras. So the screen was you kind of felt like you were completely inside the film. And the first films were that when we first went to see them, they weren't narrative films. It was just like riding on a roller coaster and everyone screaming in the theater. And, you know, it was like almost what you would have seen if you were first seeing films like in 1900, you know, like of a train coming at you. But this was like done in another kind of way. And then there were all these other kind of gimmick things. There was a film that was shown when we were really young called The Scent of Mystery. Uh-huh. And every time there would be something special that had an aroma that you saw within the film, you would hear this hissing coming from beneath the seats, and this aroma would come up. So like there'd be like a flower stand, and so all of a sudden you would smell the flowers, or there'd be a shoe shine guy and you would smell, you know, just the polish and all. So, you know, and you know, it was kind of like tacking on these things in a gimmick thing, and that one obviously didn't last, but you know, they were really, really trying hard to get people to still go to movie theaters despite television.
I think wasn't it called Smell-O-Vision too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And The Scent of Mystery is probably the first and the last of those.
Bring it back for Annette, that's what I say.
Yeah.
I know. We got a lot of good odors going on in that film.
And what about now? What about, obviously, you still go see films. Do you have a favorite cinema right now, not just in LA, but in the world? Is there one that springs to mind for you both?
It's a place. I mean, I hate to bring up a place that isn't kind of there anymore, but they're on Fairfax Avenue, Los Angeles. It's still called this, but there was the Silent Movie Theater. And they exclusively showed silent films, and I believe it was the only place that showed exclusively just silent films. And we would go there. Now it's become kind of a film lovers club, and they show all sorts of films. But at that time, it was just silent films, and so that, you know, there was a really a really special experience, you know. And just it's harder now because so many of the movie theaters are just closing down because of the pandemic, that it's almost like there's two tiers now, that it's just, you know, kind of big theaters, and then some art theaters that have managed to survive. So, you know, there are places in Los Angeles like the American Cinematheque, with the Arrow and the Egyptian, that they're really maintaining you know, what we feel is the proper respect for true cinematic art. It's amazing that those places can kind of keep going through not only the atmosphere as far as the pandemic, but just the cultural atmosphere where everything is kind of aimed towards, big franchise kind of films.
And that's part of what this series is about. It's about celebrating cinemas and the act of cinema going, and that wonderful experience that we all share when we're watching a movie with 100 or 200 strangers, and you still connect. You can feel it in the darkness, whether it's a comedy or a horror film or a really, really movie. There's something intangible about it. There's something that's hard to put your finger on, but it's such a wonderful experience. And as cinema goers, I'm going to ask specifically now whether there are movies that you can remember that have made you laugh really hard. Is there a comedy, for example, or a comedic experience that stands out for you both?
This is going to alienate everybody listening to this, but we saw Ishtar at a preview before it came out.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't know what the vibe was about, that we were supposed to really hate this film.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was, like, you know, I don't laugh at all that many things, but I thought it was really, really funny. And I've since become a huge Elaine May fan.
Yeah.
And then it opened and everybody said, this is, like, you know, just the worst film of all time. And Dustin Hoffman, you know, and Warren Beatty totally ruined their careers now. And to this day, I will stand up for Ishtar as an incredibly, not only a funny film, but a really great film.
We recommended that film when Edgar Wright's The Sparks Brothers was just opening in cinemas, theaters here in America. And so there's a really great movie chain called the Alamo Draft House that shows more, what in their minds is better films. And, you know, we tend to agree. So in any case, they were screening that week the Sparks Brothers documentary, but they wanted to have a introduction from us and to actually show another movie too, that was something we recommended. So we recommended Ishtar, and we did an introduction to it, and they actually did screen it. So I think I think the film is being reassessed by a large portion of the people that are aware of the film. And it is like, it does have some merit. So we felt vindicated that they screened the Ishtar and took our recommendation. We did a little introduction, a little filmed introduction to the film, to them before the movie went started. So.
Damn straight, Ishtar forever. Are your tastes always aligned, Russell? Does Ron sometimes like something where you're going, I cannot believe you like that film, Ron? And then I'm not suggesting that you come to blows or fisticuffs in any way, shape, or form, but are there arguments or the fallings out about cinematic taste?
No, I mean, I think sometimes just, you know, one or the other of us will discover some new film or an old film that the other one hadn't seen or hadn't been aware of. And then, so in that way, I think it's good having Ron around as a source of cool movies, so that the ones that have slipped under the radar for me, I get to find out about. Ron has a obsession with a lot of Japanese cinema. So there's films that I wasn't necessarily aware of that, you know, he tells me about. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Also
yeah.
A Kiarostami films I really love.
Yeah,
his films. But if you want to know about Korean drama, go to Russell. He's the
During the pandemic, since it was bleak everywhere, started taking the deep dive into Korean TV dramas that are like 16 or 20 part stories that are each, sometimes they're all the length of a normal movie. So you're really investing heavy if you decide to watch even one of them. It's like weeks and weeks of, having to take the deep dive, but they've got their own thing going. So it's a real specific kind of thing. I really like them a lot. Yeah.
That's amazing. So Ron for Japanese cinema, Russell for Korean drama, sorted. Just a couple more specifics now about some cinematic experiences you may have had. Horror films. Are you guys into horror films? Do you remember, is there a horror film that particularly unsettled or scared you?
One theater that near where we were living in Venice showed the Blob. So that was one of the first kind of horror movies I remember when we were really young, and that was scary, and that oozes under doors and it attacks you that way. So you kept kind of thinking when you were really young too that it was frightening, and that the ooze, the dangerous ooze, was going to come through the doors of the movie theater while you were watching it. So that was scary. Then I remember watching The Birds. It's not really, I don't know if that's not really horror. It's sort
counts.
Of boring on it. Yeah. Okay.
I'll take
and
it.
And seeing that in a theater in Pacific Palisades, where we also grew up later on, a little bit later on, and someone had actually let out a pigeon in the movie theater during The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock. And that was frightening too. I was even a little bit older and I was still scared.
Thank God you weren't watching Snakes on a Plane. That would have been...
Yeah, I know.
That would have been terrible. Have you seen the remake of The Blob, the 1980s remake, directed by Chuck Russell, written by Frank Darabont?
No, I didn't want to... I don't know. For me, there was only one Blob, so,
Trust me. Steve McQueen in it. So,
well, here's the thing. It doesn't have Steve McQueen, but it does have really good special effects. It's one of the most underrated horror films of the 80s. So.
Okay. We'll
check it out. You know, if you're willing to give Ishtar, view that with an open mind, and we'll view the remake of The Blob in the same way.
Absolutely. And two very, very quick questions, if you don't mind, as well. Have you ever become emotional in the cinema? When have you ever lost it? Has a movie made you tear up?
The end of Umberto D just destroys me. It's the scene with the old professor and his dog. It just, every time I see that, I know what's coming, and it still really destroys me. And it kind of, when you see something like that, you realize the power of cinema, and it's not manipulative in the way that, maybe Hollywood film would be. It's much more, there's something more deep about that kind of way of moving people, and so I really love that.
And for me, the final scene is, again, a final scene that's get out the handkerchiefs, is for Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Oh my god.
Just that, the final scene when the guy that guy is seeing his former love, Catherine Deneuve, and she's come back with her new life now, having married this the guy that she was wooed away from, the other guy, and then there he's a mechanic at this garage's gas station, and it's the saddest scene of all time when they see each other, but then you don't know if there's any hope that maybe there could be some last minute thing between them, but no, they both go their separate ways forever, and it's like, oh my god,
Yeah. Russell, if you think that's sad, you haven't seen the remake of The Blob. That that will have the tears streaming down your face.
Oh,
so,
wow. Can't wait.
Wow, I have to bring tissues for the remake of The Blob, too.
Absolutely. God. The whole kit and caboodle. Bring it all. Bring everything. And the very last question is, through a strange convergence of events, I have taken Sparks to the cinema. I'm paying for your tickets. I'm paying for your snacks. What do you want?
This is going counter to that, but I wish they didn't have a snack stand, actually, because
it's good for my wallet, Russell. I'm happy with that.
Because hearing somebody, trying to delicately open their box of milk duds, in the really emotional scene in a movie, and then you hear the kind of rattling of the little cardboard container and stuff, and it kind of drives you crazy. But I know the thing. I took a class one of the classes I took in cinema at UCLA. They discussed the kind of business side of movies, movie exhibition, and so I found out that that's where the theaters actually make so much of their money, is from the concessions. Yeah. So I kind of understand from their side why they do it, but it's like such huge profit in just selling a Coke that's a watered down Coke in a cup, that's where they get so much of their income. So I see it for that reason. If they have to survive, then they can sell milk duds and let the people crunch the boxes of milk duds from the movie.
Precisely. And Ron, what about you? You strike me as a nachos guy.
Oh yeah. Give me some nachos and I'm a happy man. I like in Japan mostly at the multiplexes, they have the popcorn, but then they also have caramel corn as well. Japan always wants to one up whatever was kind of invented in America. So you walk into the lobbies of the big multiplexes in Japan, and there's this incredible aroma of caramel corn, and it's intoxicating.
Amazing. Well, next time, gents, snacks are on me. That is for okay. Sure. It's been a pleasure. Russell, Ron, thank you so much for your time.
Good talking to
thank you.
And that was Ron and Russell Mayle, a.k.a. Sparks. And that is it for the penultimate episode of Celebration of Cinema, or Celebrate Our Cinemas, in association with Meerkat Movies from Compare the Market. Don't forget, Annette is out in cinemas this Friday, if you're listening to it this week. That is September 3rd, and we at Empire absolutely flipped for it, giving it 5 stars. So check it out. And join us next week for the last episode in this series. Oh, I know. It's been a lot of fun. We've learned a lot about each other along the way. And who knows, maybe we'll be back down the line with another series. But in the meantime, all I can do is recommend the regular Empire podcast, which is out every Friday, and our sensational spoiler special subscription channel featuring almost 200 spoiler specials and interviews with some of the world's leading directors, and all for just £2.99 a month. And I can certainly recommend that you should come back next week for the final episode of this series, in which I'll be talking to Mr. Elijah Wood. I suspect the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Texas is about to get a lot of love. But until then, thank you so much for listening. I'm off to send Ron and Russell a copy of The Blob remake. They may never be the same again. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.